the School of People, Environment and Planning. Such a good school to sound like it comes from. It's Associate Professor Grant Duncan. Grant, thanks for joining us in the Department of Conversation. Appreciate your time.
It's a great pleasure, Pat.
What is the school? I mean, like, how do you explain people, environment and planning? What qualifications do people finish up in your department or your school with?
It's not a school. It's just an administrative box for academics to sit in. It's got a huge number of academic staff. I am part of the program of politics and international relations. So we have politics and international relations major. And I basically teach undergraduate politics, particularly New Zealand politics. But actually, my true love is my paper called Foundations of Political Thought. So I go back to the ancients and do all of that stuff. Yeah.
When you do that, when you go back to the ancients, I mean, like, you know, what's that old saying? If we don't acknowledge history, we're doomed to repeat it. Is there a lot you learn about politics today based on the ancients? And can you give us an example if there is?
Yeah. Where to start? Just to keep it brief, because I could go on for a long time. The much maligned Aristotle, there's a lot of reasons to object to some of the things that Aristotle said, but he was really the first guy to do a systematic study of constitutions and to ask what would be the best kind of constitution to get the best results for people in terms of the quality of life that they live. And as I say, there's a lot of stuff that we reject from those days and from what he said. But on the other hand, you know, there's some enduring questions that we learn and some, you know, ethical and political issues that are still really important to us today. For example, you know, what makes a good leader? What makes a person trustworthy? Sometimes in political theory we use the word virtuous, but that's nowadays sounds sort of moralistic. But what a person like Aristotle was meaning back in the day was, you know, what makes a person practically and ethically skilled to do the job of government at any particular level? And those are questions that they were thinking about back then. And you know, we're still struggling with those questions, aren't we? Because we've seen some bad examples lately. There's a lot of talk about, you know, should we change our constitution, become a republic or something like that? You know, these are enduring questions. So I think it's very humbling and puts things into perspective to be able to go back and look at that history. And I just love sharing that stuff with students. It's a great pleasure.
A couple of things I was going to say. What does it make to be a good leader? And I was thinking, well, if you're the leader of the National Party, I think the prerequisite is to be the CEO of Air New Zealand. That's what it makes. That's what I understand. But every time I hear Aristotle's name now, it kind of shows maybe some of my upbringing. I can't not think of Monty Python and Aristotle. Aristotle is a bugger for the bottle was with the line out of one of their songs that they did.
Yeah, I remember that song very well. I can probably rattle it off, but I won't right now.
I also understand, now tell me if I'm wrong, I didn't know we were going to talk about ancient Greek when we started this conversation, but that one of the theories that I've heard, or one of the practices that I've heard, tell me if it's true or not, that in ancient Greece, they used to elect 500 volunteers. Like, you had a role of duty to be sort of a parliamentarian. And so they pulled 500 people out from the public. I don't know what the term was every year. And those were the ones that made the laws and sort of governed what went on. Is that right? And how different is that from, it's like that old saying that the wanting to be a politician should be a prerequisite for never being a politician. So pulling these people from the public and getting them to decide seemed to be how they did it. Was that better? Was that worse? Or was that just different?
Really good question. To sum it up briefly, we talk about Athens as being the birthplace of democracy. First of all, it probably wasn't, because most of the kinds of institutions that Athens had been around for centuries anyway in the Near East and so forth. But their democracy is completely different from what we now call democracy, and which I would argue is not particularly democratic, actually. But you're right that what they called the council, the boule, in ancient Athens was basically staffed by lot or by sortition. You know, in other words, people were randomly chosen. When I say people, of course, we're talking about the free male citizens here. Women had no role. We have to be honest about that. But yeah, they were chosen by sortition to staff this council, which was the administrative or executive council. Then, of course, there was the main sovereign lawmaking assembly, the ecclesia, where, you know, all of the male citizens could assemble and potentially have a say. But it was such a large assembly that you'd have to be a pretty brave fella to get up and speak, I would imagine. But yeah, it was a completely... So no, when people talk about Athens as being the birthplace of democracy, we need to be careful and realise that our representative system, which really goes back to the 13th century in England, is actually completely different. Yeah. And you could argue that it's not especially democratic because your average citizen actually has no role in it and doesn't even know what's going on half the time, you know.
It's often one of those things when we say the average citizen doesn't know what's going on half the time, when people are so certain on decisions that a government has made, but they have no idea why it was made or the flow on from that. We often hear about things like, you know, especially financial decisions, but we don't know necessarily why a government has had to make that decision, good, bad, or indifferent. We just see the end result and we either celebrate or complain on that end result, but we have no idea of the process for the government unless they explain it in great detail. But even then, you don't really know about the debate that's happened in the chambers, you know, behind closed doors to get that to that decision. So I guess that's why on some level, not to sound like an oversimplified, naive person, we elect the people that we think are going to do the best job to represent us in the country. And if they don't, we give other guys a crack because we can never know all that information that they know.
You're absolutely right. And the sad thing is that these days government is in a sense more transparent than ever, in the sense that you can go online and at home and read an awful lot about decision-making processes and consultation processes and so forth, but most people aren't bothering because there's far more interesting things to do. And so we tend to have a sort of vote and forget system where we get to vote on the people who we think are going to lead the country in the right direction. And then, you know, it could be on the flimsiest of grounds, you know, just because I like that guy and I don't like that person and so forth. And then we can go away and forget about it and maybe grumble when something we don't like happens. And so actually our system is based on a huge amount of trust because we're entrusting so much decision-making power in the hands of actually a small number of people.
Yeah. And I mean, like when you often hear that politicians don't read the 400-page bill that's led to that decision, how can you be expected to be in the public and not just read that 400-page bill, but the 400 submissions that came in before it to get to that 400-page bill? So I get it. Look, the last time we were together, it was 3 months ago when you came and had a chat with us on the Big Hairy News show, we talked about there was a story that week that we were covering and that you had commented on about the bias in the reporting of polling in News Hub. I think it's fair to say, correct me if I'm wrong, we weren't saying that the polling was biased. We were saying that the way it was being reported was, because I remember the example that we had in the show was there was one of those word clouds and the News Hub headline picked out two of the smallest words as their feature from the cloud, and the words were bad words. In fact, the biggest words were good words. And so they made an editorial decision to report that research in a certain way. And that's what we were talking about. Correct me if I'm wrong with that. But what I was going to ask you is, with what you do and you like watching this world, have you seen a change at all in the way the political polls have been reported recently? Was that a particularly egregious week, or is it much of a muchness?
Yeah, that was a bad editorial choice that week. I subsequently published another column at the beginning of this year encouraging people to read polls critically and giving in plain English some backgrounder about methodological issues in these opinion polls and why they can be inaccurate and all the rest of it. Even though the pollsters are doing their best to get representative samples and accurate results, you know, they don't necessarily get there. So I'm not saying there's some kind of conspiracy or anything like that, but Then, of course, there's the editorial decisions in newsrooms about how they're going to be read and interpreted, and that's another whole question. Have things improved? Well, no, not really. That column that I published, by the way, got me in trouble with one or two people in the polling industry, and a certain person wanted to have a conversation with me to put me straight and try to, actually, I have to say, just frankly bully me into letting him control what I say about.
Are you going to share any names at all, or is that behind closed doors? Like, who was it?
Yeah, no, I won't share.
It was David Farrow, wasn't it? I mean, let's be honest. It was David Farrow, wasn't it? No, I'm just joking. No.
But no, it was an attempt actually to bully me into, in the sense that this person tried to question my expertise and then said that he should have some control over what I write in future. And of course, that's not going to happen. So it upset one or two people because these people are quite invested in the idea that somehow they're forecasting, and when in actual fact they're not. And I mean, let me give you an example. Here we are in early March 2023. If we went back to early March 2017 or 2020, we would not have, based on polls or anything, we would not have predicted what was to come in terms of the huge events that happened around, you might remember, Jacinda Mania and all the rest of it in 2017. Yeah. And, of course, the huge impact that COVID-19 had on New Zealand politics and the election in 2020. In early March, nothing could have predicted what was coming. And here's my point, is that the polls, even if they're done really well, are basically last week's news or last week's opinion or an estimate of last week's public opinion. They're retrospective, they're a snapshot in time, they're not necessarily very accurate because it's hard to get representative samples these days, you know, with people not on landlines so much anymore and things like that. And so, in other words, we just have to read them carefully and critically. It doesn't mean that we should rubbish them. We just need to have a critical eye on them, that's all, and not take them as forecasts, because they're more like retrospective impressions rather than forecasts. And, you know, this is an election year, and already we've had some pretty big political surprises. First of all, of course, Jacinda standing down in January the 19th, I think it was, January the 27th, we had, biblical levels of rainfall. I'm in central Auckland, and oh my gosh, I've never seen anything like it. And then, of course, soon followed by Cyclone Gabriel. Now, change of prime minister, a national emergency, all of these things, were unexpected, and they've changed the political landscape. And so there could be more to come between now and October the 14th. So, just take a deep breath. It's going to be a roller coaster ride. In other words, the opinion polls, I'm often called by, reporters to comment on an opinion poll, and I always take a deep breath and say, look, don't take it too seriously. A change, there might be a shift of, say, 1% in Labour's polling or something, and people go, Labour's ahead and all the rest of it. Nah, 1% means nothing. It could just be random variation. Forget about it. Just read them critically. But they do, however, they're kind of useful. I find them useful to look at the overall trend. And that was my criticism of that, the interpretation on News Hub that time of the Reid poll, is that they were only looking at the Reid polls and not the trend in polls in between the different Reid research polls. So they were reading them out of context, and these polls are only useful when you look at the trends, and even then you can be a little bit misled, and if you get too hung up on them somehow being an accurate representation of public opinion. Yeah.
No, look, and just to explain to people super quickly, those Reid polls were quite a distance apart. So comparing that one to that one, there was a distance, but then there was several in between them from other groups. And this poll actually represented the ones that were closer to it that weren't Reid polls. So looking at the poll of polls, as they say, it wasn't that uncommon. And I guess they were selling it as, oh my gosh, look at this terrible change. It's like, well, it's a change from your last poll. but that was quite a long time ago. But all the polls between now and then have been showing the trend towards this, so it's not that big of a deal after all. One of the things from our last conversation that I wanted to pick up on, I'm going to play something as well, more to get your comment on, because we did a bit last night in BHN on the Tucker Carlson releasing the QAnon shaman footage. And I don't know if you've been following that or not at all or seen that at all. Because one of the things we talked about, and I've written this down, something that you said, is the way in which media are trying to create the narrative rather than report the narrative. Oh. And that was one of the criticisms. I want to show this to you, and I'll show this to people as well, because we did do a big bit on this last night, but something has come to my attention more about this situation. Now, for those who don't know, this is the QAnon shaman, if you're watching the video footage of this. He's the guy that was kind of the face of the insurrection. Now, Tucker Carlson got access to a whole bunch of footage, of 40,000 hours of footage of the insurrection, what was in the Capitol building, and he then spun a narrative that it wasn't violent because he spent 2 minutes of the footage showing this guy, the QAnon shaman, walking around peacefully. So that was his narrative to now say that we've been lied to about the whole thing. Now, this is a situation where people who can see the footage, you will see, and this is, I missed this last night, so we'll include this today, but also to show people about the narrative idea that you talked about last time with me. This is the shaman, and they're coming up to try these doors. Now, note if you're watching the video, the doors are blurred out. Why are they blurred out? Well, I have a suspicion about that, and I'll tell you soon. I'll just play about 10 seconds of this and listen to what Tucker Carlson says.
Here's video of Chansley in the Senate chamber. Capitol Police officers take him to multiple entrances and even try to open locked doors for him.
Right. That's all I need to play for you. Because what Tucker Carlson said very clearly is, here's Chansley in the Senate chamber. Listen to it again. Listen to what he says.
Here's video of Chansley in the Senate chamber.
Okay, I'll pause it there for those who are watching. He says, here's Chansley in the Senate chamber. We have eyes. That's not the Senate chamber. That's an exit door, if anything else. And for people who are clear, this is the Senate chamber, if people are watching. It's where the senators sit to make decisions. Here are photos of the Senate chamber. Tucker Carlson just literally said, here's Chandler in the Senate chamber, whilst they're showing them in the corridors of the Capitol building. Now, I would actually submit that this door here, which Fox News has blurred out, why have they blurred it out? I would submit that it's probably an exit door. Here's another photo looking through a metal detector for people who are watching of Marjorie Taylor Greene. But behind her, you can see those wooden doors with the glass panels in them. I would submit to you that this is actually a door to exit the building. I would submit to you that what the police officers are trying to do is get this guy out of the building. They've gone to an exit door and it's been locked, so they've turned back. However, the narrative that he is making rather than reporting the facts, I would submit, we'll play it again.
Here's video of Chansley in the Senate chamber.
He's not.
Capitol Police officers take him to multiple entrances and even try to open locked doors for him.
Okay, it's not an entrance to the Senate chamber. I would submit that it's an exit door and they're trying to walk him out. But I thought that was a really interesting example of what we talked about last time, of the media creating a narrative rather than reporting it. Now, I don't actually know if that's 100% an exit door, but he's definitely not in the Senate chamber, which is what Tucker Carlson said. And I guess I wanted to pick up on that with you as well. You're welcome to comment on what I've just shown. But I guess what I've shown is an example of what we talked about last time, and I'd love to talk to you about the media creating the narrative rather than reporting it.
Oh, well, Tucker Carlson is an extreme example. I mean, he just invents stuff, and that's, I think I agree with you that he's pushing a narrative there. And I remember on that day, I just happened to get online, wasn't realizing what was going on, and started watching what was happening in the Congress because I was interested in that moment, and then literally saw it happen live and followed with my jaw dropping to the floor. Yeah. While that whole thing unfolded, and it was violent. You cannot pretend that it was not a violent insurrection. And so to try and spin some kind of narrative like that is, it's not unusual, of course, for Tucker Carlson. He does it all the time, but it's extremely wicked. It's downplaying the sheer violence of that mob, and it literally interrupted the constitutionally prescribed process that was going on in the Congress at that time to confirm the Electoral College results. And, you know, I never thought I'd ever say anything in praise of Mike Pence, but good on him for sticking to that constitutionally prescribed process and seeing it through, even though there were death threats against him at that time. So, you know, that's a really extreme example, but I think part of the problem that we have is that, and if I can get back to New Zealand, it was a process that, in my recollection, really started with people like Paul Holmes back in the 1980s, where the interviewer became the focus of attention, not the interviewee or the thing that they're talking about. You know, the era of the celebrity interviewer, and Paul Holmes was one of the early examples of it. But, you know, if you go back, you know, people in the UK like David Frost and Michael Parkinson were early examples of that whole trend, where the journalist or the broadcaster, the Mike Hosking, for instance, is the attraction, not actually what's really going on. And so these people are given free rein to espouse theories and make up narratives and pass judgment on things on behalf of people. And they're often very, very persuasive. They're not always wrong. But I think one of the worst examples in New Zealand recently, of course, was the downplaying of Cyclone Gabriel as it was approaching New Zealand. And that sort of thing is not just, you know, it doesn't rate as journalism. It's just speculation. It's not just that it's sort of people creating a narrative out of nothing. It's actually dangerous. People can lose their lives by being misled by people like that. I'm not saying that anyone did lose their lives because of what was said on News Hub, News Talk ZB that day. But this doesn't rate as journalism. This is just irresponsible broadcasting where people are potentially being misled into going, boy cries wolf, it's nothing, you know, I'm going to go out there, and then whammo, you get it. And because often, you know, because the fact is that sometimes these cyclones come and they do fizzle out, you know, it has happened before. Hosking and Hawkesby that day, I think, are guilty of irresponsible broadcasting. Mm. And but you see it a lot. Yeah, it's like where the it becomes more about the celebrity interviewer or broadcaster, and they become the attraction, so to speak. In fact, you look at the advertisements for some of these news channels like TVNZ, they're advertising the person behind the microphone, not, you know.
It's kind of hard though as well, isn't it? Because I 100% agree with you, and it just makes me think of that television show Newsroom, which we all loved so much. Aaron Sorkin's show that he brought out several years ago, when the Newsroom decides to go back to focusing on news and less about, you know, the culture wars of the day. But if you are the most popular, meaning the most listened to or watched host, then sort of by definition, you get that celebrity status on you no matter what. So what's the answer to that then? Because if you are a Mike Hosking, and look, respectfully, I'm not going to say something very respectful. Mike Hosking's never really achieved anything himself. He's ridden the coattails of everybody else. You know, he took over Holmes's audience at 7 p.m. He took over Holmes's audience on News Talk ZB. He's kept it, and give him credit for credit. He's kept the audience. But he's never built anything from the ground up necessarily, but he has that audience now. So therefore he is the biggest singular radio host in the country. So that kind of, it's chicken and egg. Like, we don't want the hosts to be the celebrities, but when they've got the audience, they're celebrities. So how do we approach that?
Well, I guess, and to some extent you could say, well, the audience needs to be more critically minded and obviously, I'm being a bit idealistic here, But that's the purpose of a university, is to encourage people to read things critically and not to take them so seriously. And I must say, too, by the way, that I have been interviewed by Hosking in the past myself, and I've never found him to be to treat me badly or anything like that. But since that recent pre-cyclone thing, I've really wondered whether I should ever speak to these guys.
Wow.
But on the other hand, colleagues say, well, no, you should, because you still need to get your different voices out there if you can. As I say, we need to look at ourselves in the mirror as an audience, but unfortunately, look, this is, as I say, getting back to the ancient Greeks, if you like, it's really interesting. I recommend everybody read Thucydides' History of the Peloponnesian Wars, if you haven't before, because you see a very, very similar effect going on, where you have powerful demagogic leaders like Alcibiades, who are able to persuade audiences to do what turn out to be, in the end, really, really foolish things. In this case, I'm referring to the Athenians' expedition to attack Syracuse and Sicily, which ended in military disaster. It's a horrible story to actually read, but it's fascinating to read how the assembly was persuaded into doing that. And so I think one of the problems that we have is an ancient problem of political persuasion. And I don't like to compare people to sheep. That seems to be the obvious kind of metaphor. But we have to ask ourselves, not so much, in other words, we shouldn't just complain about leaders or influential celebrity interviewers. We also need to think, what's in it for the audience to follow such people, to believe them, and so forth. There's a payoff there of some kind. And, a lot was written, for instance, by people like Adorno about, well, why did people follow Hitler, and things like that. But I hate to bring that example into it, but in a way. But, we have a lot of soul searching to do in terms of, what's the emotional payoff for us in enthusiastically following one person and sometimes intensely hating someone else. And so we need to think, I think, critically about how we react and listen, or not listen, as the case may be.
I'm really interested. It's a bit of a side note. You were talking about, questioning whether you would, be a guest on Mike Hosking again. In the world of academia, and you must talk to your colleagues about this, how do you draw that line? Like, I wonder why the hell anyone goes on Sean Plunkett's show, for example. Because he typically seems to get people on who he disagrees with, and he tries to paint it as an open and honest dialogue, and then he just shouts at them, talks over them, and won't let them out. Like, I really do wonder the line in the sand between, like, a Hosking, contrarian, but, we can still get our message out to a big audience, and someone like Plunkett, who is basically, I don't know, evil personified. I don't know, my words. And it doesn't seem to serve any purpose. Although, like, I heard Niwa on with him the other day, and he was shouting at Niwa, and it's like around Cyclone Gabrielle and that sort of thing. I wonder, where is that line, and how do you decide as an academic, this is too far. There's no point going on there. It's not going to serve the greater purpose.
Good question. I do often ask that. And I remember speaking to Heather Du Plessis Allen one day, long after she had rubbished a girl.
Oh, about her
participation in that school protest. And I was talking with the person, the backroom person before that.
Set up producer?
Yeah, the person who rings you in advance. No. I said, look, I noticed that, and that was wrong. And I'm not going to say anything about it on air, but I just want you to know that I disapprove before I talk with Heather. All right, I'll still talk with her, but I'm letting you know that I disapprove. So there is, I think we have to get our message across like that. But it with some of the, I think particularly with news talk, I am having questions now. But on the other hand, as I say, I've never been asked to speak to Plunkett, and now that you've mentioned it, I hope I never get asked. But and But yeah, no, it is an important ethical political question that, you know, us academics ought to be, and I would say that we ought to be, a lot of my colleagues, I think, are unwilling to be in the media, and I understand why. It's not, you know, can be tricky, it can be scary, but, you know, we ought to be out there, particularly those of us in social sciences, contributing independent thought. We don't always get it right, that's not the point, but, you know, at different points of view. And if we can get a different point of view out there to the News Talk audience, well, then that's not a bad thing. You know, otherwise,
Mike just because that's the flip side. That's the flip side. Even the Plunkett situation with his QAnon alt-right conspiracy theory lunatic audience, if people don't speak to them with a contrary opinion, then they never hear it. So I can see both sides, but when I just hear him screaming at people, I'm like, yeah, well, that seems to be. I mean, if he was like genuinely looking to engage and, like, you know, being a gracious host and being a complete the opposite position, that's one thing, but it's more the abusive rhetoric that I wonder about. But anyway,
let's not talk about him. I was abused by a reporter online, I would simply never speak to them again. I did refuse to speak to Paul Henry once after that appalling interview he did, where he I mean, it was obviously set up and he'd had a few to drink, but then he was reported as saying some really quite sexist things. And it was just like, mate, you've just gone too far. And I just said, no, I'm not talking to that guy. I do have limits. But on the other hand, as I say, I sort of feel that, you know, you're going to get your hands dirty. There's no pure politics out there. And things are always a bit murky anyway, and so you know, my point of view isn't perfect. I don't have a recipe for utopia, so it's best just to get alternative views out. You see, my objective really is that not to tell people what to think, but to give them some context and a bit of history, or, you know, let's look at the principles at stake, so that people can make it easier for people to make up their own minds in an informed way. And if I can do that, then I've achieved something. And in election year, there's going to be a lot of that, you know, sort of stuff going on. And by the way, we're talking about stuff. We'll be doing another one of those stuff surveys this year. So jump in, people, and do that when it comes out, because we really like to incorporate, you know, like to look at the full range of political opinions in the country, not to tell people what to think, but to feed back to them and say, this is how people are thinking and feeling about things at the moment. And to try and, I guess, you know, make the political debate in this country a little bit calmer and more civilized. Not to tell people, oh, you can't say that, or you have to think this.
Yeah.
But to say it's fine if you have differing points of view, let's just talk them through with some civility.
Look, I agree 100%. I was also wondering as well, to talk more generally now about politics as well, the idea of politics as a game of populism versus a game of good policy. Because it seems at the moment both Labor and National are playing a populist game. Labor's pulling away from some policies that aren't necessarily popular, but could be good policy. Like, I still want to question the Three Waters situation and ask the question, how does Gore fund now their $300 million issue with their infrastructure and stuff? And they're pulling away from it because that seems to be popular. Whereas the opposite seems to be happening with National, is they're going down almost like a Helen Clark left-wing line with these ECE payouts for families and wanting to have, you know, an investigation into the banks. And I wonder if both sides are putting out their populist opinions at the moment that maybe don't sit with their core of who they are as a party. So where is the line between playing populist politics to get voted in versus good policy, which may not be as popular, but is still good policy?
Yeah, good question. I mean, at one level, I mean, isn't that what people want, you know, is that their representatives will do what the people, the majority of people want. And you might call that populism because it's popular. But on the other hand, isn't that why we have elections and a and a supposedly kind of in inverted commas democratic government? But I hear what you're saying, and I'm not actually, to be honest, I'm not entirely sure that the Three Waters Plan is good policy, because you could argue that, setting aside the co-governance controversy, you could argue that it's simply kind of obscuring bad debts in bigger balance sheets, and in the end, there's a price to pay. So, I know this is probably a little bit exaggerated, but you could compare it with those collateralized debt obligations that almost brought capitalism to its knees in 2008, you know, due to hiding subprime mortgages into larger tranches of debt. So, you know, there was an obscuring going on and an underpricing of risk. And so the danger is that we as a country, by using this system, obscure those bad debts at local levels. The other thing is that water services are inherently local. And one of the problems with the Three Waters Plan, for instance, you know, we've had floods recently, for example. Councils are still going to be responsible for flood management and for dealing with the consequences of floods, you know, stop banks and things like that. But they're going to have control of the stormwater drains taken away from them. And so it sort of cuts right down the middle of what's actually turned out to be a really, really important question. So, no, I'm not entirely convinced, actually, that Three Waters is good policy, but I understand what you're saying is that it is trying to address...
Let me just expand on something small, just to make sure people are clear on what I'm saying. What I'm saying is the current system is broken and there needs to be a solution. And local governments have not injected the money for the last 50 years to stay up with it. Some have. Many haven't. Like even here in Dunedin, we basically have two of our three waters are pretty good. The third one's under, you know, still needs good work done on it. So when I say good policy, what I'm talking about is, especially for places who need it, who literally have no other way of getting it other than being centralized, because Gore can't afford $50,000 per ratepayer for the next 30 years. You know, it's just not possible. That this is a solution. Now they're moving away, we've said all the way through the last 6 to 12 months that I think one of the problems, it hasn't been communicated very well, and it hasn't been a very good relationship between central and local government over it. But the idea that something needs to happen, here's a solution, now that they're running away from it because it's rating poorly in the polls, rather than either fixing it or communicating it better. So I don't want to make it seem like I'm sitting here with, yay, Three Waters is the best thing since sliced bread. But I guess what I'm saying is, it feels like the reason they're dropping it is not because the bigger concept was bad conceptually to fix a bigger issue, but the reason they're dropping it is because people don't like it. That's the populist kind of thing that I was wondering. Yeah, just exactly. to put out there what I was thinking. Liking it.
Yeah, people's reasons for not liking it are not necessarily very good reasons.
No, especially when you get groups like Groundswell, you know, muddying the waters, all three of the waters actually, and you can see fairly heavily that a lot of the groups who are opposing it is 100% because of co-governance, because of
But also, hang on, farmers are opposing it also because they're not on town supply, so therefore they don't want to pay for something they don't use.
Sure, but that's a ludicrous thing for farmers to think, because all of us pay for things we don't use all the time. I spent 10 weeks speaking to the mayoralty candidates for Dunedin coming up to the last mayoralty elections, and all of them were against the current Three Waters system, but many of them were talking about, you know, why should I pay for their next door? And then some of those same people said, we need better public service in Dunedin and government should pay for it. I'm like, what the fuck are you talking about? That means other people are paying for our... So you won't pay for someone else's water, but you want other people to pay for our public service. It doesn't work that way, and we constantly are paying for things that we don't use. So I don't find that as the kind of, you know, gold standard, so that therefore being my argument wins, because there are probably hundreds of things that the government pays for that I don't receive. I mean, any kind of taxation for families, for people who don't have kids, that goes on and on and on and on and on. So I mean, I know what you're saying about what they're saying, but I don't find that necessarily a strong argument against it.
No, and I think what you're trying to drive at here is that ultimately there's a huge problem that we actually have to deal with.
Yeah.
And I think that's really the essence here, isn't it? And it's not just water. Yeah. There's a whole lot of other infrastructure issues that we're simply fudging and not dealing with, and we're putting it off, going, oh, that's too expensive, oh, we can't afford that. But then on the other hand, we can't afford the consequences of doing nothing about it either.
All those mayors, all those same mayoralty candidates, all were like, you know, Three Waters is ours, we're going to keep it. But none of them therefore then said, and your rates are going up by 30%, because that's actually the addendum they should all be saying.
Yeah. Now, the other thing, well, in Auckland, we pay user charges, and that's been the case since the big water shortage back in 1994. And that was the solution. Well, part of the solution was just to charge people directly. And that, for many people, would be a bridge too far in a lot of parts of New Zealand. And so there's this assumption that we should just have water for free and it should be drinkable out of the tap. Well, it's great if we can have that, but people have to realize it costs money.
Yeah. So, look, jumping backwards, not to get into a debate around Three Waters, the goods, bads, and indifference, but the idea of, because sometimes good policy hurts, you know, whether it's a taxation or like hurt, and sometimes we don't like it, but it's the right thing to do. I mean, we could look to COVID, and even though there's lots of controversy around was it the right or wrong decision now, I think you can see by our death rate. I mean, I would like to say that publicly, that because of, even though our numbers and our per capita numbers of infected people has gone to most of the Western world, our death rate is so much lower. I think that that harsh thing that we were forced into doing was worth it based on more New Zealanders that are alive today than would have been dead. So I'm okay with saying that hurt and that was harsh and there was a reason for it. So some good policy hurts. It seems like an election year, and it seems like both parties are doing it at the moment, are running towards what's popular, even if it doesn't sit with their political brand. Like, for example, let's regulate the banks. National saying this the other day. Well, let's look at regulation for the banks. That's probably one step too far to say let's regulate. Or the basically working for families for ECE payments from National. That's not a very national policy. I'm wondering what you think about how that sits for, authentic sort of a political core statements versus, we often hear about the lolly scramble. The lolly scramble at election year for everyone to just like, we're going to buy your vote. And look, it is basically buying your vote, saying if you get us in, you're going to get this benefit. So what do you think about those two things? What do you think about those two things? I'll leave it at the end of my question.
With the family boost one, it was definitely National raiding traditional Labour territory, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Totally.
And the other thing about it is that targeted the family, not the individual. And so usually National Party solutions tend to be more individualistic. But of course, the other thing about it is that it will mean, if it gets implemented, that the money would go directly into parents' bank accounts, and they'll see that money, and they'll kind of go, so it's a direct payment to the parents. So it will matter. But it does sound uncharacteristic of National. You could argue that it's a symptom of something that's actually good about the mixed member proportional system, is that it tends to make the major parties more centrist rather than to polarise them. And so they start competing for the same ground. And so often National does get accused of shimmying too far to the left. And Labour gets accused of shimmying too far to the right, but you end up with a kind of centrist consensus, and then people complain, oh, they're so boring, they're all the same. But would you rather have US-style polarisation? You decide which is worse. There are those sort of symptoms. And I think what you're getting at here is that tension between what technically is good policy, which may actually hurt, because you have to say to people, look, particularly around these big ticket infrastructure items, and we're feeling the pain of poor infrastructure at the moment, particularly on the East Coast, we really ought to say to people, look, we're really behind on dealing with these issues. There's a huge bunch of bills that we've got to pay to raise the capital to hire the people, the engineers and the road workers and so on and so forth, to get these jobs done. It's going to cost an awful lot of money. I mean, Auckland must be one of the only sizable cities on earth that doesn't have an efficient public transport connection with its international airport. And we still bicker and moan about actually getting that job done because, oh, it's too expensive and, you know, and so on and so forth. So we tend to balk at the expense. And yes, it's not cheap, but I think the typical problem with New Zealand is that we're constantly cutting these corners. We don't want to invest and we end up not doing things, you know, or doing things on the cheap, building roads on the side of fragile hillsides, which then collapse in a heavy downpour. You know, you live with the consequences. It costs you sooner or later, one way or another, doesn't it? So, you know, yeah, I just personally, I would like it if our politicians would be a little bit more honest with us. I think you're right. And say, look, let's do some serious policy work here and say to the public, if you want first world infrastructure, this is what it's going to cost you. And our policy, sorry to have to say this to you, to raise taxes and rates so that we can get it, so that we can have that first world infrastructure that you want. And you complain like hell when you don't get it.
And the problem is they won't say that, and then someone will get elected. And then when they get elected, they'll do that. And then there'll be an outcry. You never had a mandate to do this. You never told us you were doing this. I also think that maybe we as the public need a mindset shift. There we go. Because when Christchurch earthquake happened, tragedy, loss of life, horrific, worldwide news. The country suffered, Christchurch suffered. I don't remember there being a bleat about the national, you know, the national, all of us, sorry, I'm getting my words mixed up, the National Party. I don't remember a bleat about, like, we don't want to pay for Christchurch because it was this event that shocked us. Now, I would say the pipes in Havelock North where people died from, I think it was Campylobacter or Legionnaires' disease, that's also a national emergency, but we see it differently because it's not a singular event that, you know, that can be put up on the screen of CNN. Where really, I don't see it, I mean, I do see it as different, but I think it should be considered as a national emergency like that. And if we, the public, kind of looked at some of these things like infrastructure, like the mayor of Waimakariri is one of those people who are going like no to three waters and that we've looked after and had big investment in our infrastructure. Waimakariri had 50 different jobs by the government done after the earthquake because it's just north of Christchurch. So of course your infrastructure is fine because it's just been paid for by all of us. But if we had a mind shift change, those of us out here going, actually those pipes are a national emergency. I'm not saying like the Christchurch earthquake, but so was the Christchurch earthquake. We were happy to get behind that. Let's get behind this as well. So how much of this is us kind of going, we need a mindset change as well as the government needs to be more honest or the political parties need to be more honest of the day. And we need to understand that some things are going to hurt. We've got to pay for stuff. So taxes, no one likes paying taxes. They're going to hurt. Let's be honest about it and then move forward, I don't know, as one, kumbaya. I don't know what to say about that.
No, I hear what you're saying. And I think we need to be more proactive about it rather than waiting for a disaster to happen before we go, oh, we have to fix that up.
But I
think you're right about Christchurch. And I don't remember Aucklanders complaining about contributing through our taxes to the rebuild of Christchurch.
Of course.
And I would hope that people down there wouldn't complain when Auckland gets hit by a volcano. Do you know what I mean? Which is going to happen one day, they say. So,
or floods.
And it's going to ruin the city, you know.
Yeah.
But my point is that we could be more proactive because we've been doing things on the cheap for too long, and the vulnerability of roads, for example, the lack of or the deterioration of our rail network, inter-island ferries included, all of those things that we've just let deteriorate, we should have an honest conversation with ourselves. What is it going to cost us to rebuild these things to a status that they actually work efficiently? I once actually got the train down from Auckland to Palmerston North, and frankly, I'd never do it again. It was not a comfortable trip, you know. But my point really is that we're not thinking proactively. Why wait for the disaster to teach us the lesson? Because it's going to cost us sooner or later. And yes, so a lot of those questions about building stronger. I mean, honestly, you know, the Esk Valley has, for instance, flooded dramatically in the past. I'm quite surprised that people were allowed to build at ground level bungalows in the Esk Valley, given historical experience. But if you were to insist that people build on stilts with flood refuges on top of their buildings, they would have complained like hell about nanny state, you know, and regulations and all the rest of it, too expensive. And then they complain about the consequences of not doing it. What are you going to do?
You know? Yeah, you can't win, can you? Hey, let's talk about your Substack, because I'm right. You've just started this up recently, the Substack. And I wonder, last time we talked, the article you wrote on News Hub, it was very evident that the media didn't want to pick up on an academic critiquing the media. So as part of the reason, and I want to ask you about a couple of your articles in here as well, is one of the reasons you've started up the Substack, which is Grant Duncan PhD.substack.com. Oh, my eyes are terrible. Is one of the reasons you've started it, because now you're sort of the author, literally, of your own destiny. You can decide where it's going when, and people can enjoy it as they want, and you don't have to worry about the media either picking up on it or not?
That's a fair point. I mean, I don't have many subscribers, so I hate people subscribe. But you know, it's partly that freedom. You'll notice that I don't mention Massey University on it. That's partly in accord with Massey University policy, actually, about use of social media. But it's so that I can just once a week really send out a newsletter to reflect on something that's going on, maybe anticipate some of the things that are coming down the pipeline, not to make predictions, but to look ahead to what's coming. It gives me a certain sort of freedom. I must say that, you know, I've got to take my hat off to the people at The Conversation, particularly I should acknowledge Finlay McDonald, who's really, really helpful in helping me get some of those columns out through The Conversation, which will get me far, far, far more readers than I would ever get on my Substack. But on the other hand, it's just kind of practice, so to speak, to be out there making my thoughts available to people. They can comment, and not that many do. So partly to have that sort of freedom from, well, what do the media think or whatever, you know, having to answer their questions is the thing. It's not often that I get a chance just to say what I'm thinking rather than answering a reporter's questions.
Yeah, sorry for doing that. Sorry for asking you all the questions, Grant. you say you don't do predictions. Where does the line fall between prediction and opinion then? Because I want to ask you about one of the articles about who do you trust. And we talked about this in our BHN through the week. I did another podcast with comedians, and I talked to Radar this week. And we talked about when you say something with confidence and you say it loud enough, people believe you. And he was talking about, as a comedian, you stand on stage and you talk about what happened to you just as you were driving into the show, and people believe you. What they don't realize is if they had turned up the night before, that would have happened as you drove into the show the night before as well. Funny how that happens. And we talked about this poll in particular, so I'd like your thought on it. Your article on Substack is Who Do You Trust? And you say that's 53, a redone poll on 22nd to 27th of January asked whether respondents trust each of the two major party leaders, rounding out the figures. 53% said yes and 27% no for Labour leader and Prime Minister Chris Hipkins. The rest didn't know. 37% said yes and 44% said no for Nationals leader Christopher Luxon. I advise caution when reading surveys, but you can't ignore such a big gap, 53 to 37, and Luxon should be concerned that more said no than yes in his case. We've been talking a bit about this to do with trust. Why don't people trust Christopher Luxon according to that research? And I was wondering if it's to do with kind of Radar's theory. I don't feel like he says it loud enough and especially confident enough when he speaks. And I'm like, oh, I don't know. And then the 3 days later, like, what did he do the other day? They were talking about, I can't remember, but on Sunday they said one thing and by Wednesday he was saying the opposite thing on the AM show, sort of thing. And I'm not filled with confidence, and confidence, I guess, begets trust, maybe. What do you think it is that the research would show there people are less trusting of Luxon than Hipkins?
Ooh, that's a really good question. I've actually written a book about political trust, and it's a really, I mean, it's a fascinating subject in itself. And to some extent, of course, our trust is focused on individual leaders. And we do put a lot of trust in politicians generally. I mean, we may not trust them in a sense, but in another sense, we're trusting them with a heck of a lot, because mm-hmm. they have significant law-making and policy-making and governing powers. And when we vote, it's implicitly we're putting a lot of trust in them, even though we may not actually kind of entirely trust them as individuals. And indeed, history has shown us that we're foolish to trust people with unlimited or ill-defined powers. I mean, you know, we learned that rather drastically in the 20th century, that we have to severely limit constitutionally people's powers, because ultimately no one is 100% trustworthy. Trust is never and needed. We don't want it to be a blind faith in an individual. It's basically a kind of confidence that we have confidence in you, that you're competent as an individual. You're basically honest. You're not out to diddle the system. You're out to at least try to do what you genuinely believe is right for the common good, and not just for your own self or for your mates, whatever. And there's that poll that I've cited right there, but also, of course, there's been a number of polls which have shown Luxon lagging significantly behind previously Jacinda Ardern and now Chris Hipkins in preferred prime minister and favourability polls. And, you know, obviously, it's very, one can only go on intuition here. There's the polls, but then the question is, well, I think you're asking, well, why? Why isn't Luxon gaining that confidence and that trust? And I can only really go on the sort of things that just talking to people or looking at right-wing comment in particular on Twitter, for example, is quite revealing that, you know, a lot of right-wing people are saying, for example, just from my own, you know, limited observations, that they see him and National as becoming too left-wing, too woke.
Right.
I
love that term so much. It means absolutely nothing, and nobody understands it when they use it. It's fantastic.
Sorry. I know, but people use it with great confidence.
Yeah. They say it confidently and loudly, Grant.
Yeah. But I think my impression is that he's failing to come across with a certain kind of authenticity. And then there's another question in the back of my mind. Well, does it really matter all that much whether he comes across with authenticity or not? Does he have sensible ideas for, you know, running the country? Getting back to your point before about good policy as compared with what's popular. So there's a real kind of a whole range of issues bubbling around in us, isn't there, about how we respond to leaders, particularly in this sort of hyper-mediatized age, where the face and the voice of the of political leaders or, you know, all sorts of people is brought very directly onto our screens, just like, you know, we're doing at the moment, and stuff like that. So we get quite a visceral reaction often to individuals, which is not necessarily, well, actually, a lot of the time it's simply not rational. And, you know, there's decades and decades of research behind this about what people frankly call political ignorance and the irrationality of the average voter. And a lot of political scientists are kind of saying, well, it's sort of rational not to fully rationally understand what's going on and just to vote with your gut, given the amount of time it would take to make a rational decision, whatever you mean by that. And so, but yeah, in other words, you know, these polls based on a kind of subjective opinion about the favorability, confidence in, trust in, or likability, whatever, of a particular leader are actually important. It's a subjective thing. And so our answers to the question as to, well, why isn't Luxon managing to cut through, so to speak, and gain that confidence. I mean, you compare it to the sort of electrifying moment in 2017 when Jacinda Ardern took over the leadership of the Labour Party obviously not everyone liked it, but certainly on the left, it had this kind of, there was this moment of electrified, yes, I want to, you know, we were running one of those stuff surveys at the moment, and you could see the Labour supporters piling in, saying things like, yeah, I'm going to vote Labour now because of Jacinda, and so forth. So she just had that effect. And, you know,
ironically, they might be saying, I'm going to vote Labour now because no Jacinda. That might be what's happened recently, what we're seeing in the polls. It's interesting that just, what is it, 5 years apart, it's gone from, and I don't know this, I don't have the research, but the way that Chippy got that boost, and that, like, it would have been, I don't care how National spins it, it would have been devastating for them to have Chippy in his first preferred Prime Minister poll be higher than someone who's been working on it for a year, basically created an atmosphere to help get rid of Jacinda, and then still was number two. That is devastating. And I remember what it was. It was actually the Three Waters conversation where the National Party representative came out on Q&A and said that rates would not go up. And then by Wednesday, Mr. Luxon had come out saying rates will go up for some people. So that's what I'm talking about when I'm talking about the confidence. The messaging doesn't seem to be there in that. But yeah, my co-host on BHN, Chewy, has been saying since middle of last year, he thinks that Luxon will be rolled before this election. And when these little things happen, I'm like, no, I still don't reckon. I'm not in agreement with you. And we're not going to predict, Grant. But but when you see these things happening, you go, I can see where at least your perspective could come from. Because, yeah, it seemed that in October, November of last year, this was Nationals to lose. And she's certainly game on, if nothing else right now. It's a fair fight. And that's amazing from where it was.
Yeah, I was just responding to questions about the Taxpayer Union Courier poll that came out yesterday, still showing, you know, Luxon's favourability right down there compared with Chippy's. National ought to be really, really worried about that poll result. It's just because in the party opinion poll, National and Labour are kind of neck and necking, it seems. But you look at the comparison, thanks for bringing that up. Chippy, he's up there, but Luxon really struggling around sort of a kind of almost a negative.
It is negative two, I think.
Yeah. That should really be worrying National.
I mean, if David Seymour, and I know that you're very impartial when it comes to your commentary, so I can say this, you won't. If David Seymour is more favourable than you, you know there's big problems in the world. You're not supposed to laugh at that, Grant. You're impartial. Very clear.
That's right. But I think David probably has more fans than I do.
Yeah.
So it's cool.
Yeah. All right. It's going to be a fascinating run. And look, I'm a bit like you. We talked about this poll last night, the Courier poll. Tell me this then. I mean, not to continue the conversation because we're wrapping up now, but am I right in that Courier often leans a bit right in its results, like in its trending? Because if I'm right in reading that through, that Courier often leans a bit right, then this is even more of a not such good result for National.
It's an indictment, really. And I mean, as I say, we can all have our own subjective opinions as to why Luxon is failing to cut through, failing to get that that kind of positive response from people. You know, people often compared him initially to John Key, but he's just not having the effect that John Key had. God knows why he had it.
He's the John Key that you don't want to have a beer with. Remembering that old saying about John Key.
So, you know, National ought to be really worried about this. It's still a while to go. There's plenty of opportunity between now and the election for Labour and Hipkins to screw up somehow, or to people just to get tired of them. It's possible that their presence at the moment in the polls has got a lot to do with the national emergency.
For sure.
And so forth. So that tends to give an incumbent government a bit of a boost, but as I say, there's plenty of time between now and October for people to start to, you know, that confidence to wear away and to get people to maybe to just get tired of Hipkins or the opposite. I don't know. You know, events, dear boy, events, you know, will overtake one way or another. Yeah.
Hey, Grant, it's been an absolute pleasure having you in the episode today. Let's tell people again, if people want to see your meanderings, your readings, the Substack is called Politics Happens.
And it's free.
It's free. And so there's no paywall at all. A lot of people put paywalls on their Substack. So grantduncanphd.substack.com is where you find that associate professor from Massey University, Grant Duncan. Hey, mate, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a blast.
Thank you. Great talking with you again, Pat. Yeah. Thank you.